Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join us for an extraordinary conversation with Joanne Harris, the celebrated author of Chocolat, as she unveils her first fantasy novel in 6 years, The Moonlight Market. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this captivating discussion promises to blend the allure of fantasy with the thrill of hidden worlds.
Hello, everyone. Hi. Welcome tonight with Joanne Harris. Joanne Harris.
Hey, thank you. Wow.
I'm Kasim Ali. I'm an author and an editor, and today I will be interviewing the splendid Joanne Harris. Most of you, if not all of you, I hope no one's stumbled into this event and has no idea who Joanne is.
If you did, the doors are locked now.
I'm going to read a quick little bio. When I was looking Joanne up, I mean, I know of Joanne, as many people in publishing do, because, you know, you're kind of a person. There was just...
Definitely a person.
Capital P person is what I mean. There's a lot out there, so I tried to condense it as much as I possibly could, but forgive me if I go on for a little while. Joanne Harris is the best-selling author of Chocolat, which was made into an Oscar-nominated film starring Juliette Binoche. Joanne has written novels, novellas, short stories, game scripts, the libretti for 2 short operas, according to your website, several screenplays, a stage musical, and cookbooks. Kind of insane. Her books are published in over 50 countries and have won far too many awards to list here. She's judged for the Whitbread Prize, the Orange Prize, the Desmond Allen Prize, the Betty Trask Award, the Prima Donna Prize, and the Royal Society Winter Prize for Science. She was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2022, and was the Chair of the Society of Authors for 4 years, and is currently a member of the Board of the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society, which is an incredible organization. The Moonlight Market is her latest book, a sumptuous fairy tale of a book that explores hidden worlds and the limitless power of true love. Please give it up for Joanne Harris. Sorry to make you clap again. Okay, so my first question. The Moonlight Market is a beautiful fairy tale of a book. And though most people will know you for the brilliant Chocolat, not least because of the Oscar-winning film adaptation, this is not your first foray into fantasy, and I don't think it's going to be your last. So I wanted to ask you first, what brought you to fantasy in the first instance, and what keeps bringing you back to it?
Well, you know, I think I started off writing fantasy. I don't think I've ever been very far away from fantasy, even when I'm writing books that are set nominally in the real world. There's often some element of magic or difference in perception. And I think this is because all of us have had such exposure to this very rich tradition of folklore and fairy tale across Europe and the world, and we have so much coming in from elsewhere too to enrich that, you know, it's almost inevitable that as writers we are going to be influenced by that in some way. There is, you know, there's a long conversation to be had about fairy stories and why we believe in them on some level even now, but I think, you know, fairy stories originally were not written for children. The Victorians did a bit of a job on us over fairies and fairy tales, making us think that they were for children, and then Disney did another job on us and made us think that they were safe. They were never safe. Fairy tales are the secret language of the human subconscious. They are there to bring out the things that we fear and the things that we want, and bring them out into a safe space and make them comprehensible through story. And so that's why we keep coming back to them, because on some level, all of us want to believe that love can save us, or monsters can be overcome, or you can be the hero of your story, because that's ultimately the message that fairy tales give us.
What keeps bringing you back to fantasy? Is it this idea that it sort of is underpinning everything that we sort of feel and breathe through our storytelling, or what is it? What brings you to fantasy again and again and again?
Well, fun, mostly. Nearly everything I do is either for fun or to annoy other people. Writing this sort of thing is both fun and it annoys my mother, which is a nice bonus, but also it allows me to explore things in a way that I wouldn't quite be able to get away with if I was writing just about the real world and the experience that we share. So it allows you to riff on stories that we know. it allows us to build metaphors and explore things which are uncomfortable or painful or difficult inside the metaphor. And also, you know, from a personal point of view, I quite like writing about fairies and big snakes and dragons and monsters without having to hide them as something else. So sometimes I will write something which is much more unreliable. And so you can take it as a fantasy or you can take it as a real story with an unreliable narrator. But sometimes I quite like to swing right over to the proper fairy tale side of things and go, okay, let's write a story with fairies, but let's make it different. Let's imagine that fairies are like, in this case, fairies are like insects that have changed their sylvan setting and have modified their camouflage to an urban setting the way moths do already. You know, what if fairies did the same? What would they turn into? So that's basically the premise of this book.
When I started reading this, I was sent this and I read it in like 2 days because your writing is incredibly accessible, really beautiful. It just sort of like took me through the whole thing. It has a feeling of like a timeless fable. So I was reading it. I'm currently living with my best friend and her husband for reasons we won't get into because this is not my event. And he loves fantasy. He loves fantasy. And so he immediately looked at this and sort of kept asking me lots of very annoying questions about it as I was trying to prepare for this. And I told him that it felt like I was being told a story that had been passed on from generation to generation to generation. This idea of like, here's this fairy tale told down through, you know, people. What inspired you to write it in this way? And I specifically want to talk about if you can explain the structure of the book to the audience, but also specifically, yes, this way, but also why this story?
Well, some of you may be familiar with a book that I wrote fairly recently called Honeycomb, which was basically 100 little stories, which also created one novel. So it was short stories, but also a novel built out of pieces. And I wrote it in a very particular way because I wanted to try to evoke classic fairy tales without retelling any. I wanted them to be new and to be original, but still have that feeling of something that might be old, that something might be remembered from childhood, that something might be the inheritance of those fairy tales many of us were brought up on. And so I wanted to keep that narrative element, and I really enjoyed doing it. And the reason I wrote such tiny short stories was that actually most of those stories were written on Twitter initially when Twitter allowed us to do that kind of thing. Now we're not allowed to do that kind of thing. All we can do is just watch in horror as the ship goes down. But, you know, in the early days of Twitter, I rather enjoyed telling stories, and I had to do it in a kind of, in a short form way. But also, it felt like I was telling stories rather than writing them. It felt like an oral tradition of folk tale. And I quite liked doing that. And I liked the way my style adapted to fit. And I thought, well, I kind of like to keep doing that and see how it works. So I did that with Honeycomb, and I kind of got into the habit of doing it. And when I started writing The Moonlight Market, at first I thought, well, maybe I'll just write the whole of it in that style. But in fact, something that had started off as a novella ended up being expanded into a full-length novel, and I realized that I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to have a kind of juxtaposition of the classic fairy tale style with a more modern kind of narrative. And I thought, well, how am I going to do this? And so I wrote my short form story, the one that I was going to use as a bridge for the rest of it. And then I thought, well, I could have that as the beginning, and then the story would take over from that. But it felt like a very odd kind of progression. I couldn't just have 50 pages of fairy tale and then go into a modern story. So I thought, okay, I shall break it up, and I'll feed it through the story like I did with Honeycomb, but differently. And so every section of the book has part of the ongoing fairy tale, so that you can start to see as the book develops that actually it is the same story that's being told on two levels, one a fairy tale level, the other a human level set in present day London. And one echoes the other, and one gives little nudges to the other and hopefully nudges the reader into understanding what's going on. Because it is quite a complicated story, at least in some ways.
There's a lot going on in it. There is a lot going on in it. It looks like a tiny book. I mean, when I was sent this, I thought, gosh, there's nothing going on in here.
But actually, there's hardly anything there.
There's nothing here.
You'll not even know you're reading it. You won't even know that you've read it.
And that feels like a really great time for you to do our reading. So Joanne's going to read us a teeny tiny bit of the book. I really didn't want to spoil anything of this incredible, incredible book for you. So if you could set us up to where we are and then do the reading.
So the fairy tale starts with two characters that, if you've read Honeycomb, you may have encountered before, very briefly in a story there. They are the Moth King and the Butterfly Queen, and they are classic opposites attracted briefly, but they have a very unhappy marriage, and partly because they don't get on and they're constantly using each other against each other vis-a-vis their son, who loves them both and who doesn't know how to please them. Eventually, circumstances happen where he escapes through a web into the worlds, a web spun by the spider mage, who is his guardian, but also the court magician. And he finds his way into the world of the sightless folk and is lost to his parents. And this causes a permanent rupture between the two, and they go their separate ways. And this is the second little installment of this. The Moth King and the Butterfly Queen grieved for the loss of their only son. The Moth King's grief was cold and grim. The Butterfly Queen's burned hot and bright. Both were unhappy and longed for their son, and longed even more desperately for the love they had once shared. But both were too proud to admit it. And so each went their separate way. The Queen into her world of air, the King down into darkness. Divided by grief, they slipped into the cracks between the worlds, sorrowing and incomplete, and were lost to their own world forever. Lost in exile, they found their way to a city of stone and bridges and tunnels and underground vaults built on a great winding river. And there they held court, each to their own, alongside the people of that world who, being sightless, could not see the events unfolding around them. The Butterfly Queen kept her word, and the Moth King his promise that never again would a butterfly ever fall in love with a moth, but that both would feed on the hearts of their foes and thrive on their quintessence. And so the King and Queen became rulers in that sightless world, he in the shadows, she in the light. And the many tribes of the Silken Folk, the Hesperidii and the Lesenii, the Nymphalidae and the Papillonidae, the Frenati and the Hedilidae, came to them in their thousands, with glamours and magic at their command, and swore them their allegiance. And still they endure, after centuries of war, still grieving for their vanished son, too proud for reconciliation, taking their nectar whenever they can, within that city of ancient stones and gleaming glass towers, and asphalt and roads and plastic and concrete and tunnels and trains.
You call humans the sightless ones in this book.
Yes.
when I was reading it, I sort of started coming up with all these theories as to why you were doing it. Like, is the fairy tale the real story here? Is the sightless ones supposed to be a sort of metaphor for smartphones and technology and how we're all glued to our phones? Is it this? Is it that? And then I thought, I'm actually going to speak with her, so I'm just going to ask her myself. Why do you call humans the sightless ones?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I mean, partly this. I mean, for purely practical reasons, because they do not see the Fae. They don't see the people of the Moth King and the Butterfly Queen at all, unless they want to be seen. And people who have read Honeycomb will know that there's a story behind this. It's the one story that I actually took from existing folklore rather than inventing it all myself. And it's one of the very first ones in the book. And it's from an Irish folktale called The Glamoury Eye. And it's about a midwife who is called late at night by a stranger to deliver a child. He promises her gold, so she goes with him. And he takes her in his little donkey cart to a hut where there is a woman in labor. And the labor is complicated, and the midwife says, "You must leave me alone to deal with this woman." And the man is very reluctant to do it. And eventually he says, "Yes, all right, I'll leave you, but there is a ritual that you must perform in my place if I'm not going to be here." And he gives the midwife a little bottle, no bigger than the tip of her thumb, and says, "There is an elixir in this bottle. You have to anoint the child's eyes with it. It's something that all our people have done for generations. It's very, very important. It has to be done straight away at birth. But you mustn't get any of it in your eyes because it could send you blind. So the midwife labors away, finally delivers the child, a healthy son, and wiping the sweat from her brow, she manages to get a little bit of the elixir in her own eye after having anointed the baby. And suddenly she can see that she is not in a hut at all. She's in a palace. And the woman doesn't look at all the same, and the baby doesn't look at all the same. And she thinks, uh-oh, hang on, I've done something here. I am in danger. So she goes out pretending to have seen nothing. She accepts the payment in gold from the man, who also looks very different, who in fact looks as if he's wearing a gold crown and looks like he's a king, and the donkey cart looks like it's a carriage, and the midwife is still not saying a thing. Nope, not at all. Can't see a thing. She realizes that the money he has given her is just a handful of dead leaves. She thinks, you know, I'm not going to say anything about this either. And she goes back home thinking, I have escaped some terrible fate. But of course, afterwards, she continues to see things that other people can't see. And she sees goblins, and she sees fairies, and she sees all kinds of things that exist under the existence of all her friends. And she gets used to it. But there is always this disquiet that she is able to see with this one eye, this glamoury eye, things that nobody else is allowed access to. And then in old age, she goes to a market, and among the market stalls, she sees him. She sees the man with the crown, the king of the Fae, and her eyes meet his, and she realizes that he knows that she's seen him. And she turns to leave and finds him standing in front of her. And quicker than you can describe it, he yanks out her eye. And she never sees the Fae again. And this is why humans are the sightless ones. And this is why sometimes being sighted is more dangerous than not.
It's a terrifying, terrifying story.
Terrifying story. You can see why I wanted to use it. And I used it as the basis for, well, a whole bunch of stories around that kind of mythology.
So as I was reading the book, I was reminded of like several of the books that I'd read in this sort of space. Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, which was like the biggest, I don't know if anyone here has read it. If you haven't, it's a good book. I was reminded of Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, The Rivers of London by Ben Aronovich, A Darker Shade of Magic by V.E. Schwab, The Bone Season by Samantha Shannon, and Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which are all very sort of differing fantasy books, but the thing that brings them all together and the thing that brings this into their cohort is that they're all set in London. And not just the London that we all recognize, but a London that has a sort of underbelly, something underneath the surface that the sightless ones can't see, but it's still happening underneath everything. So related to this, I have a few questions. I had to break it up into three questions just to make it easier for myself. The first question is, what is it about hidden worlds do you think that we are obsessed with writing and reading about?
Well, I think there's always an attraction to the idea that there are things that we can't quite see, but that we can sense. I think we are set up as human beings to be fascinated by liminal spaces and the concept of liminal spaces, the idea that there could be something right there. You don't know what it is, but you can feel it, and it calls to you. I think there's also a fascination with the idea of doors, that you might be able to find a door to one of these spaces and get somewhere else. And that is all over folklore and fairy tale, from the Pied Piper to Tamlin, to any story of humans finding their way into the world of the Fae and the things that happen to them there. So I think that's very much entrenched in our whole folkloric upbringing. But I also think that so many fairy tales were set in the woods, the forests. And that makes sense, because there was a time when the forest was the scary place. You could get lost in the forest. There were wolves there. There might be witches. But now, of course, the forest is the city. That's where the real scary things are. That's where the monsters are. That's where you could get lost. And so I wanted to transfer that mythology from one place to another. And of course, cities are wonderful because they are multi-layered places. They are places that are kind of layer cakes of everything they've ever been. And London is a great example of this, because London has existed for such a long time. And there are so many archaeological layers, and it's always changing all the time. And it has this resonance. And the more you learn about London as a city, the more you realize that there are still little fragments of mythological places lying around. My old friend Chris Fowler, who died last year, who was basically Mr. London, that's all he ever wrote about. All his books were set in London. But he was also incredibly knowledgeable about all the spaces in London, the alleyways, and we used to go for endless walks, and he used to say, oh yes, there was an old gibbet here, and this is where Jack the Ripper killed his fourth victim. And he was this encyclopedic mine of knowledge about London, and so a lot of that found its way into this book. Because to me, those are also fairy tales, and they are the folklore of our evolving current mythology. And so it made sense to kind of splice them into something more traditional, if you like, and to see what would happen.
You sort of answered my second question. So my third is sort of less about London and so more about, and you've kind of touched on it, what inspired you to set this sort of fantasy in like an urban place? Because the book is, the modern part of the book, which is set in London, is very busy. There's lots of things happening. London is like an incredibly loud place to be in. And so I wanted to know, why set it in a place that is quite, I think, quite hard to write about in a fantasy setting because there's so much going on?
Well, I think it's partly because there's so much going on that I liked it, because I live in a fairly rural place and people behave differently in rural places. They greet each other, don't they? They know each other. In London, if you greet somebody, they will probably look away because they will fear that you're going to talk to them about Jesus or try to sell them something. Interpersonal behavior isn't the same because there are so many people. In a way, London is much more of a kind of hive mind, and people are very busy, and they don't notice things, and there are things that they don't want to notice either because they're very uncomfortable. And one of the things that makes me uncomfortable is the number of homeless people when I go to London, how enormously it has escalated and how most people don't even seem to know that they're there. This makes me uncomfortable because I don't live in London. Londoners manage to somehow blot it out. And so to that, they're also sightless because I suppose that psychologically it's very difficult to live with. So I wanted to write something about that too. I wanted to write something about the social impact of living in such an environment and the dangers of living in that environment. And also from a practical point of view, I go to London a lot. If I was going to write about an urban setting, that would be the one, because that's the only one that I know well enough. And I set it in King's Cross because that's where my little London flat is, the one that I go to when I go to work there. And it's also on the same street that Chris used to have his London flat, and he used to walk me around all the breakfast places around King's Cross because this was a man with an encyclopedic knowledge of where to have breakfast. And he would tell me stories about Battle Bridge. It was called Battle Bridge, the Battle Bridge Basin, and what it used to be and what happened there and its historical impact. And so when I first started writing this story, its working title was The Battle Bridge Fairies, which I still kind of wish I'd kept. But it was judged to be too obscure, I think, for some of our non-London-based readers, so I changed it.
The Moonlight Market is a pretty good title. It's a pretty good title. It's enticing.
It's not bad. I'm not good at titles once I've already decided on a title. But, you know, I managed to come up with something in the end.
Editors will always, you know, have their way. So in The Moonlight Market, as you've referenced, there is this whole hidden world. But in the hidden world, there are these characters who, as you were talking about very briefly at the beginning, have hidden parts of themselves from even the people who can see them. This idea of like the duality of the self is something that I'm actually kind of obsessed with, because me and my friends are constantly talking about code switching. It's really funny. I think that there's a modern phenomenon where we just give words to things that have always existed. So code switching, if you speak to someone on TikTok, is a thing that only started 5 years ago, but actually has been around for as long as humans have been around. This idea that when you go to work, you present a completely different side of yourself than to the one you present to your friends, to your family, to your strange neighbor, to the person in the chicken shop who gets your order right every time, because you've got to keep them on the right side. And so I wanted to ask you, could you speak on this idea of duality in the book, but also where it comes from for you?
Well, I think actually all my books have some element of this. I've been fascinated for a long time about the personas that we give ourselves, the way we allow other people to perceive us, and the way those things can change. Because actually, if we go back to magic again for a minute, really, if you boil down our understanding of magic, it pretty much boils down to one concept, well, maybe two: perception and transformation. Perception, how we see the world, how the world sees us. And then transformation, metamorphosis, changing ourselves, changing the world. And so a lot of what I write, even when it's not explicitly about magic, is about people who can change the way people perceive themselves, the way people perceive them. It's about the ability to exercise change on either a small community or the world as a whole. And this thing that some people have, this ability to do that, we talk about it in English in the language of magic. When we think of words like charm and charisma and enchantment and glamour, all of these words have dual meanings. One of them is absolutely full on magical thinking, and the other is that strange aura that certain people have where they walk into a room and it doesn't matter if they are brilliantly good looking or not, but somehow everybody looks at them because they have something, they have that thing. And so that's something that runs through a lot of my writing. And I've played around with it in a lot of ways, but here it is in an explicitly fantasy way, because my fairies, who are the inheritors of the descendants of the butterfly queen and the moth king, have learnt to coexist among humans and to go unseen. The butterflies are totally visible because they are very flamboyant, but they go in unseen because people just assume that they're normal people, very flamboyant, and the moths have kind of gone the other way. The moths look like the kind of people you wouldn't notice, and so they're almost invisible. But in both cases, these creatures, these fairies, are hiding in plain sight among humans, and they look like humans, and yet they have these other properties. And I kind of liked that. And my kid and I used to play games in London, walking through the streets, working out what animal people were. And we used to say, well, most people are pigeons, but oh, there's a penguin there. Oh, and that's a red setter. And it was a fun game, and we used to do this a lot. And it kind of got me thinking, you know, who's a human here and who's a fairy? Are they a butterfly? Are they a moth? Would we know? And what would they think looking out from that crowd unseen? How would they perceive the world? And it just got me, it got me kind of into the groove for writing this book.
Related to this idea of the hidden worlds and the hidden self, if you will, Tom, who is our main character, who is essentially a regular schmegular kind of person.
Tom is an ingenue. He is a human, at least as human as you get in this story. And he's, shall we say, objectively really quite annoying, but he's a good guy, really. But I found that he annoyed me incredibly, because I really wanted him to open his eyes and see, and he wasn't doing. But, you know, he gets better. He's slightly different to regular people because, you know, he has a little bit of insight, and he does have some capacity to see the hidden world, but he's a photographer, and he really only believes what he sees through his camera, and that's what interests him. The rest of the world isn't interesting, but it acquires interest and focus when he sees it in the context of his art, and he's absolutely devoted to his art, and he really doesn't have time for anything else, which is why, of course, he's my hero, because people like that just deserve for life to happen to them, and it does.
What I loved about Tom's photography is you make not quite a big deal in the book, but it felt I could feel almost like you, Joanne Harris, making a big deal about it in the writing, is that he uses film. And so there's this idea in the book that whenever Tom is taking a photo of somebody, he's sort of capturing a piece of their soul, which is something, you know, we used to believe, which is kind of a fairy tale in itself, that we used to believe cameras and photos took something off you when they took a photo of you. I wanted to ask about why the choice of photography and specifically film, but I also kind of wanted to ask about, again, this was me sort of thinking with my like writer hat on, but I was sort of wondering if you were making a point about technology and the digitalness of it, because there's a sort of beautiful antique nature of film and the sort of the really ritualistic way of sort of getting the negatives and developing them and waiting for the photo to sort of appear to you. So this is a really big question, and I was quite excited to ask it. But specifically, why photography? Why film? What are you trying to say with that?
Because photography is ultimately the closest thing we still have to alchemy. It's something which takes light and captures it somehow and then puts it onto glass or celluloid and then prints it onto paper and captures the moment. It is a magical transformation. It's a metamorphosis. And the history of photography is really interesting too. And when we look at how it's developed and how long it has existed and all the stages it's gone through, again, there's something almost fairy-like in that. And I was also thinking of some of the great photographic hoaxes, the Cottingley fairies is one of them, of course, and how that feeds into our modern folklore. And I wanted Tom to have a vision. I wanted him to have some way of seeing the world, but because he is a person who has been brought up to disbelieve in his desire for magic and to mistrust his impulses, he has to have some way of focusing this core of romanticism inside him. And so he does it through art. And he says, well, I'm doing this because it's art and it's science and it's chemicals. And there's nothing magic about it. And by the way, I've photographed something and it's visible on these negatives. And it wasn't there when I took this picture. But, you know, that's all right, because I'm sure there's a scientific reason for it. So I had fun with magic and science, which to me is that they're very, very close in photography.
Mm. The other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about, you're pulling on a real tradition here, and I read on your website that this was the first time you felt that you'd really written about love. And so love has a real strong pull in the Moonlight Market. I would say it's like the inciting incident, to use an editorial term, is Tom falling madly in love with a person who he encounters. It's what holds his hand as he moves through the book. In your own words, it's the first love story you've ever written. Would you talk about why the choice of love pushing this story forward and not something like anger or hatred or revenge or ambition or greed, which when we start reading the book and we have that first insert from the fairy tale and you read about this beautiful love story between the Moth King and the Butterfly Queen and what happened to them, what pulled them apart, you could see a version of this story where it's the negative emotions that propel what happens here. But you've chosen love, so why?
Well, I've written about love before, but it's never been at the center, at the heart of a story before. And I think I wanted to write, because so many classic fairy tales are love stories, and very often they are the story of a quest of one sort or another. And very often it is the hero who goes on a quest to either save the heroine or to somehow deserve her. And I thought, well, I'm not going to write that. But I am going to write a love story, and it will be a sort of quest, and it will be about all kinds of love. I wanted there to be a whole spectrum of different aspects of love in the story. And so there is the question of true love and whether it exists or not, or whether it's an illusion. And then there is toxic love, which started off as one thing and has turned into something else. And then there is the love that we can't see, which is right in front of us, but we just haven't noticed it because we're looking at something else. And then there's doomed love. And then there is unrequited love. And they're all in there. And it was a way of exploring this thing which fascinates writers and which so many storytellers see as the end result of telling a story. And I wanted to deconstruct it and to riff on whether we believe it or whether it's just a fairy tale, whether this too is something that we want to believe in, but is just always slightly out of reach. And so I put Tom through quite an awful lot of things in pursuit of his true love. And if you want to find out whether he finds it or not, you really must read the book. It ended as it should, is all I'm saying.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I won't give anything away, I promise. I wanted to move a little bit away from the book now and sort of talk about you, which is, no, don't panic.
Which
don't
is
panic.
Much less interesting.
But you're a real figure in the publishing industry. And I think you have like a real voice in this industry, and you've been, I don't want to say you've been around for a long time, but you...
I have been around for a long time, it's fine.
Well, you can say
you
it.
You can say
I
that.
Won't say
it's
it.
Fine.
And one of the things I really wanted to get your opinion on, and I thought maybe this might be of interest to the audience too, is over the last few years, there's been a real boom in fantasy. So I'm thinking about people like Sarah J. Maas or Leigh Bardugo or N.K. Jemisin, and more recently, Rebecca Yarros. Has anyone here read Rebecca Yarros? She's sort of become a huge, huge name in the space. As someone who's been writing, not just writing and publishing, but also in the publishing world for I don't want to say such a long time, but for a while, where do you think this is coming from? And I always kind of wanted to know what you thought about the fact that when I was thinking about recent names, they're all women.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? And I'm not sure why, but it's striking that it is a very woman-led phenomenon. And I think there are a number of intersectional things here that might explain it. I mean, one is basically reality sucks, and so nobody really wants to live in the real world anymore, even in literature. And so we are looking for escapes everywhere. We are reaching out for places which are not the view outside our window, and I completely understand that. But I also think that in fantasy we find the weapons and the mindset to defeat our real life monsters, and I think that's partly what they're trying to do. You know, how do you defeat monsters? With courage, with integrity, with love, with all these things that storybook heroes and heroines have, all these things that we would like to somehow summon into our world, because my God, we need some heroes, we need some integrity, we need some love, we need some compassion, and that's all I'm going to say about the Tory party so far. But we know who the monsters are, and we know how to kill them. And much of this is from fantasy, because fantasy gives us that push. And I also think that it's probably no accident that many of those writers are women, because, let's face it, the people in charge of the show are mostly guys, right? They put us here. This is not to cast any shade on any gentleman in the audience, but the world as we know it is still very patriarchal. The monsters are still there in their place as largely white, public school educated men of a certain type. And, you know, it's not impossible that one of the reasons that young women are turning to fantasy is that they feel empowered, taking control of the narrative in their way. It's a theory.
It's a good theory. It's a good theory. I when I was writing this question, I did think, I am a man, but I'm going to ask it anyway and not add my opinion to it. We're just going to ask the question, accept the answer, and move on. But one thing I was thinking of was, so I'm Pakistani, and the people in my family who told me the stories of, like, the jinn, for example, who are these, like, mighty creatures who do terrible things to you, like my grandmother told me if I don't eat my dinner and pray on time, were women. It's women telling stories down to their children and daughters telling it to their children when they have children and so on and so on. And in my own family, I actually, not to talk about myself too much, but a lot of people were quite struck by the fact that I had become the storyteller and not, say, my sisters, because it's seen as a sort of, like, womanly thing to do. I really enjoy it, and that's what I'll say about that. And I just sort of wanted to posit that theory to you, whether this sort of, like, reintroduction of women to the fantasy space in a way that's, like, really booming is not something new, but is in fact just a reclaiming of something that women have done for generations.
No, I think you're right. I think it's not new at all, but it is very much, as you say, what women have done. And I think it's interesting to look at the development of folklore and fantasy from its earliest parts, because there has always been a woman's influence there. And where the stories were oral tradition stories being told to families and round hearths, there were women there. When they were written down by people, when we think of the Grimm brothers and Andersen and people like Perrault, all of a sudden they became men's stories and they were published in books and they made money. And so you have this division. But the narrative is the same. The narrative keeps moving. It doesn't really care who it goes with, and it doesn't stay with one person either. But I do think that there is a sense that men write important things for posterity, and women make up little fairy stories for children. And it's a very unfair way of thinking, but it has been the dominant way of thinking, certainly since the Victorians. And current publishing still has a little bit of that drag factor, whereby, you know, men are supposed to tell important things about the nature of the world, whereas women can just have fun with their little hobby. I think younger women now have seen that there is something to reclaim here, and they're being quite muscular in doing it, and good for them. And also publishing, which after all is there to make money, has realized that their voices do have power, and has suddenly realized that actually they're making rather a lot of money for them. And so they're being listened to more, which is great.
It sort of reminds me, as someone who's worked in publishing for 8 years, this sort of idea that black and brown people read. They seem to read.
So they do.
And women do too. Publishing is truly, truly an industry. I wanted to talk about something you and I were talking about just before everyone arrived, which is sort of AI. And this is related to, sorry.
But the biggest monster of them all.
But this is related to Tom's obsession with film and my sort of working theory that maybe you are not so much against technology, but wary of its power and its reach into our lives. And so I wanted to give you like a little bit of time to just talk about how you feel about AI. And I would say use as many expletives as you would like.
Well, I think the problem with AI is that it's a linguistic problem more than anything else, which means that it's also a cognition problem because there's nothing intelligent about it at all. It's just predictive. It's basically there to give the easiest answer to any question you ask, which is fine if what you want is something very basic. But if you want the answer to something complicated, if you want a complicated answer, if you want something to make you think or laugh or cry, or remember something 20 years on, don't ask AI to do it, because there is no intelligence there and there's no feeling. There is just an algorithm which is there to predict the next little piece of code. And the idea that you should use it for art is completely the wrong way around, right? Because in every piece of sci-fi we have ever read, AI was there to do the dishes and to do the housework and to do the really crummy jobs that nobody wanted to do, while we, the humans, spent our lives thinking about higher things and doing art, not the other way around. And so somebody somewhere has got the power imbalance wrong, and I am fine with AI as long as it's a tool, and as long as we know that it's a tool, and as long as the people who are using it as a tool are not suddenly replaced by the tool by somebody else who thinks it will make more money that way. So no, I'm not against technology at all, as long as we understand that technology is not a magic genie that will come out and do things of its own volition. But, you know, we do want to make sure that we don't engineer the tools of our own emotional and intellectual destruction, as well as the destruction of the rest of the world, because that could happen too. And that would be a bad thing and not a good end to the story at all.
My best friend's husband, who I'm currently living with, remember I told you I'm not talking about that today. He had, we were talking about AI, and he actually made this really good point, which I think you've just made too, which is that in the 1980s, science fiction was all about AI doing your accountants, your accounts and the math and all the terrible things that we hate doing as people. And that we were the ones free to, in his own words, become the people from WALL-E, which I'm not sure is what we want, but I can see what he was saying. And so I'm going to tell him that Joanne Harris had the same idea. You and her are of the same intellect.
Well, you know, the more science fiction you read, the more actual science you can try and preempt and preferably avoid seeing happening. But yeah.
I'm going to ask you one last question. And then it's your guys' turn to ask the questions, because I've run out of questions. I don't have any more. So there will be a microphone going around after we answer this last question. And this last question is sort of my favorite question to ask authors, actually. It's a little bit of a twofer, but one is, what would you say was very influential on you when writing this book? And that can be in terms of, you know, films or TV shows or books themselves. And the other thing would be, when people do buy this book and read this book and love this book, what would you recommend they read next?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. I don't generally have direct influences when I'm writing things, because very often there's been something kicking around in my brain for years, and then it finally comes together with something else and makes a story. But I think quite a lot of it was all the time I've spent in London, looking at the behavior of people and wondering why they are so different to where I come from, and trying to work out, you know, what psychological differences there might be in living in such a crowded space with so many people on top of you, and how important it is when you are living like that to see selectively, because otherwise you're going to go crazy noticing everything. And another thing was your inciting incident, if you like, was it's very easy to locate. I was on the tube with my son, who lives and works in London, and I saw a moth on the inside of the window. And we had, he and I, a little conversation about fairies and moths. And it was kind of, you know, what if fairies had evolved the same way as moths? to go unseen in London. So, you know, the tube could be absolutely full of fairies and we wouldn't know it, and they would be living in the tunnels. Because I had previously, a few years before, read a really interesting book about homeless people in New York living in subway tunnels during the winter so that they wouldn't freeze to death at the top. And the book had been written by somebody who'd visited one of these communities, who reckoned that there were something like 5,000 people living down there at any given time, which was horrific, and which meant that I could never ever get the tube in New York without looking out the windows to see if I could see people. And of course, I never did, but all that came out of that kind of thinking. But I wanted to write a fairy story about it. I didn't want to write something gritty and realistic in that way, because I wouldn't have been able to find anything redemptive about it at all. And I wanted to write a love story. I was in the mood for writing a love story. I thought, you know, let's do this. There's been so much objectively grim stuff happening. You know, let's do something redemptive and slightly more light-hearted than what I might have done in the past, because I was still recovering from writing Broken Light, which, though a lot of fun, was emotionally draining and not what you would call fluffy. So I thought, you know, I want to write something different.
And a book that you might recommend someone who would read The Moonlight Market, love it, and want to read something else like it?
Ooh, that's really tricky, because people see different things in books. Books are more like Rorschach tests than anything, and so people see what they need in books and they take what they need. It's not necessarily what the author has put in, or whether the author is even aware of having put it in. But I would say, well, what I have been reading a lot of recently is child ballads. And I would say, find the text of the child ballads and read them all, because this is where the folklore of the British Isles really lives. And they are generally not terribly well known. We know Grimm's fairy tales much better than we know our child ballads, but they're really interesting. And it's worth looking them up. They're probably free on Project Gutenberg or online or something. And then maybe go and dip into some writers like, I mean, yeah, you mentioned Neil Gaiman. I would say Stardust, actually. This is closer to Stardust than it is to Neverwhere. In my head, it felt as if it had some of the same energy. But also maybe read some Terry Windling, because she writes very well about the fae and folklore and fairy tales in a very particular way. And maybe also read some Aliette de Bodard, who she is mostly a science fiction fantasy writer, but she also has the inspiration of different kinds of folklore. And she writes from a Vietnamese point of view, which is really interesting and new to me. I love her. And, you know, if you're going to read anybody, then definitely read some Ray Bradbury, because he is at the heart of pretty much all my fantasy writers, because he was the first writer that I was really aware of as a child. And his transformative power over me has been considerable. So maybe read something Wicked This Way Comes.
Thank you. Thank you, Joanne. It's time for your guys' questions. I hope you have some.
If you pop your hand up, we'll try and get the mic to you as quickly as possible. Can we start there and then go there, please? And then at the back?
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm a bit nervous because seeing you is a bit like seeing Beyonce. It's a big deal.
That's a very lovely compliment, but I don't quite believe you. Go ahead, please.
I've read a lot of your books, and many of them many, many times. And what I love about them, and would love to know more about, first time I read a book like Chocolat, for example, I read it as a love story and about chocolate and about men, and I loved it. And then I became a mum, and I reread it, and I read it over and over, and the whole series, and Blackberry Wine, and Five Quarters, and I read them completely differently as stories about motherhood. And so many of your other stories I've read as that as well. And I wondered what it is about that that you think is such a powerful theme that runs through so much of your writing.
Well, I think you've kind of nailed it. I think because motherhood is transformative, parenthood is transformative, there are things that I wouldn't have been able to write before I became a parent. And my friend Chris, who was the first person to read the manuscript of Chocolat, told me that he thought that it was a love story between a mother and her child. And I thought, yeah, okay, I'll buy that. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I think it was. I think that as writers, we tend to find the things that are most important to us to write about, whether we are aware of this or not. And one of those things was being a parent. And so before Chocolat, when I wasn't a parent, I didn't write about parenthood because it wasn't dominant in my life, and I hadn't had the life experience to be able to talk about it. As soon as I had, I did, and it became a kind of a constant theme. And it's now one that I don't think I could not involve in my work in some way. It just wouldn't work that way, because it's like being in love. You don't write a love story unless you've been in love. But once you have done, everything has love in it. Thank you. I think we had one there, and then we had one in the back there.
Hi. You've written about so many wonderful characters, and I just wondered if there's one particular one that you might identify personally with.
It's a really difficult question, because in many ways I have to identify with all of them. Even the bad ones, I mean, perhaps particularly the bad ones, because somebody has to love them, and if I don't, then who will? But I think, you know, when I'm writing characters, I have to have something to connect me with them. So it has to be either a level of experience or a feeling, some sort of emotional connection. I don't think I can say that I have one that is more me than any of them, but there are some voices that are easier to do. And when I was writing my Loki books, my Loki voice is basically what I was like at 16. And it was disturbingly easy to do that voice and to go back to that voice. And so I did enjoy writing that very much. But, you know, whether he's more me than Vian or Renaud or any of the characters in here, it's very much a moot point.
Thank you.
Do keep going. Shall we go there, please? And then we'll go up to the back there.
Evening. My question is more of a technical bent. Since you have written across many different styles and different lengths, short forms, through operettas and tweets as a book, I was just really curious as to at what point do you make the decision for it to be a novella or poetry? You know, Jigs and Reels was very different from what came before, things like that. I was quite curious as to how that process works.
It's an interesting point. I don't generally think it through too much, because I'm much more of a kind of impulsive, organic writer. And so I will just start writing something, and then usually it will become obvious to me whether it's going to be a short or a long. Usually when I start writing something, I will know whether it's going to be a novel, because there are going to be more strands to it than if it's just a novella. With a short story, I usually approach it with the idea that if it's going to be a short, then it's something that I need to get out of the system as quickly as possible. So I think, okay, I couldn't spend 2 years in this place, but I do want to spend an afternoon or a week in this place. And so it will be something, it will be like a snapshot of something. Whereas a novel is much more multi-layered, and I know is going to be more complicated. And so, you know, snapshots are relatively easy, because you can just send them out into the world, and they are just mostly based on one idea. If it's based on lots of ideas, then I know it's going to be longer than that. What I don't think about, and what I don't really know at all until the book's finished, is what genre my publisher is going to tell me it is, because I am utterly uninterested in how they're going to categorize my book or what bit of the bookshop they're going to put it in. That's their job. Mine is just to write the thing. And otherwise, I would be thinking too hard in the future about how it's going to sell, and not enough in the present about how it's going to end, which to me is the important thing, really.
And then I think we have time for one last question.
Hi. I really liked what you said about the idea of books being like a Rorschach, because I think that's so true. When you reread books, sometimes you see something different in them. I wondered, do you ever reread your own books, and are you ever surprised by what you find there?
Hardly ever. The only time I reread my own books is if I have to. Either because for instance, I reread a whole bunch of my own books last year because I was recording them as audiobooks. And I thought, whoa, I don't remember writing this at all. Or, really? All sorts of funny reactions. I found that I'd forgotten quite a lot of what was in there in terms of the detailing. And it was really interesting. So there's that aspect of it, which is fun. I really like and I enjoy recording audiobooks, and they're fun, but sometimes they can project me into a past place that I wasn't expecting. And I also reread them if I'm writing a sequel, or in the case of what I'm doing at the moment, a prequel, because I need to get the details right. And I also need to try to get back into the voice, With my Chocolat books, when I wrote The Strawberry Thief, I just finished recording the audiobook of Chocolat, and it was much, much easier to get into the voice having done that. So I nowadays I keep telling myself, you know, you really must do this again, and you must read the thing and preferably read it aloud. And that way it will allow the voice to feel more authentic. So yes, there's that. But no, I wouldn't do it normally. I wouldn't just sort of sit there in my library reading my own books like a weirdo. Thank you so much, everybody, for that. And thank you for being such a great interviewer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joanne Harris, everyone.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.